Welcome to the Rooted in Change podcast.
Hey everyone, my name is Jan and you're listening to the Rooted in Change podcast. This show features European clean tech champions and their solutions to tackle the climate crisis. Today's guest is Emilio, co-founder and CFO at Unbound Potential. So energy storage is one of the biggest bottlenecks in the energy transition, as we probably all know by now. And most of the time, innovation here focuses on making existing batteries just a bit better, cheaper, or sort of more efficient. Unbound Potential takes a different approach. The Swiss startup is developing a membrane-free redox flow battery. The result? It's simpler, faster to produce, and highly scalable. They've just raised one of Europe's largest pre-seed rounds. We'll talk more about that later, which is a strong signal of confidence in their vision. We learn more about the technology and the traction as well as future plans. And with that, welcome, Emilio.
Thank you, Jan, for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. And obviously, congrats on that big announcement. We'll talk more about that later in this podcast. But let's start with an easy intro question for you. So I mentioned that you're one of the co-founders and the CFO of the company. But sort of what's your background up until this point? How did you become the co-founder, and what led you to this point in time?
Fantastic. Thank you for the question. So it's a really good question because sometimes this is a very deep tech space. So some people wonder how I came along. So
yeah, exactly. And you know, it's you tend to start always with technology first and jump right in. But I like to start the conversation sort of on a human level. So tell me.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. So I am an economist by training. So I, during my bachelor, during my master, I studied at Bocconi University, where I focus really on industrial economics, public finance, and development economics. This is a branch of economics, let's say, that examines the causes of growth, and key areas of study usually include resource allocation or structural changes and policies to foster sustainable development. And after that, I took quite a break where let's say this enters to part aspect of my personality. I'm a very curious person. I like exploring. So I worked for a while in Uganda. I worked on with NGOs, research institutions for Kenya, right, in Stockholm, in Princeton, in the United States. Wow. And after all of this, I figured out that I wanted to challenge myself, and I went into a PhD, but in economics, rather typical maybe in this deep tech space, where I actually focused on behavior organizational economics, which is a branch that analyzes psychological factors like biases and motivation beyond like the pure rational behavior, mm-hmm, and that influence an organizational internal dynamics and employment relationship. And of course, my research was on environmental economics. And so right. Here we go into climate change mitigation, yeah, policies, supply chain analysis, market dynamics. And let's say out of this, connected to where I stand today and the startup, that came to major convictions. One is that good ideas without executions are worthless. And this is something almost like a mantra that brought me, yeah, to this reality. And the second one is, by studying all of this and researching these topics, I realized pretty, I would say late compared to where and when I could have figured this out, but that in the biggest roadblock in the energy transition today at the European but also global level is really technical, and the missing piece is really stationary energy storage. And so even if I don't have directly worked and on energy storage, let's say I was inspired a bit by this book by Scott Bensley. I don't know if you know The Messy Middle.
Yep.
They said the best way for a startup, let's say, to really disrupt an industry is to be an outsider. And so right. When I met the rest of the co-founding team that had this idea of a membraneless flow battery, and we realized we really not worn out by the industry and by all the problems, we thought, okay, we have a really cool idea, strong opinion.
Right. And you sort of bring that outside perspective to the table.
Exactly. Right.
How did you meet your co-founders? Because I think you described your journey very well into And obviously, as a CFO, you know that financial and economics background is highly helpful. But and you sort of underlined how the sustainability interest was there all along, right, with your work on the NGO level and on global impact topics. But what's the connection to the rest of the
Yeah,
co-founders?
this. So this was so when I was doing my PhD, I was at University of Zurich next to ETH, and the two universities are so close to each other. I ended up going to for some. I was teaching some classes there, and also I was receiving some courses. So one of these was entrepreneurship, and I wanted to bring a couple of ideas, and I needed some technical co-founder next to me, and just happens that from ETH there were other people looking for the opposite.
Right. Perfect
And
match.
so, exactly. And so, for some, we took a course, Startup Campus. This is at ETH, and I met two of them, four of the other co-founders. And we spent evenings brainstorming on these ideas. We were just having fun working together, basically in a rather relaxed environment. And well, relax. Finishing a PhD or postdoc is never relaxing, but
As
but let's
relaxing as it
say,
can be.
yes, like rather not actively seeking for each other, but just exploring this as an opportunity. And then came a moment where we realized there is actual possibility here, and we applied to a grant for a German agency for breakthrough innovation, Sprint, and then basically we convinced them, and so we decided to make it a reality right away. And yeah.
Yeah, super exciting. And I think, again, maybe this is the pattern, and we'll dive more into this later. But I like the way you just phrased it, right? The idea sort of came to you. You weren't actively looking for it. Like, you were having fun, you were brainstorming in a relatively relaxed environment. And maybe this is sort of a very good position to be in, because then when you find that idea, you can be convinced that it's a really strong one, and that might be different to
Exactly.
others who,
Nobody, yeah. Nobody's
yeah,
forcing you. I mean, the
exactly.
technical idea itself came from the CEO, David Taylor. So, and then it was working on cooling systems, and again, the same inspired curiosity brought him to really delve into that, and then, yeah.
And that, I mean, that's a perfect bridge for me that I'm going to cross now, because in the intro I said that, and on this podcast we've had a lot of battery tech, and rightfully so, right? Because it's a crucial piece for the energy transition. I think everyone can agree on that. What's the specific problem that you're tackling? So, sort of, why are you such a big deal? I think the question is.
Yeah, why do we even exist?
Yes.
So exactly. So no, I love it. I'm more I love the question. So the big problem we are tackling is scalability. So if we try to detach a bit ourselves from the current market dynamics, what's going on really today, and trying to project ourselves in the future, we are about to experience one of the biggest transitions that humankind have experienced. And this really revolves not only on purely the energy production space, but really how the entire value chain is designed around fossil fuel versus renewable energies. The big problem we are trying to face is that there is a missing piece here. If you try to project the grid scale energy demand that will be needed to couple with renewable energy sources, you will soon realize that the figures are around 140 terawatt hours by 2040, which is equivalent to roughly, you can count in 160 megatons of lithium ion that would be needed to deploy this. As of today, to give you an idea, we have 240 kilotons
Right.
of lithium ion extracted. And if you look at all the reserves in the world, we talk about 30 million tons. Now, we are a factor of three off compared to what is actually needed for a net zero transition. And I'm talking just about resources. Then, of course, you need to dig this out. It takes around 8 to 10 years, and you need to anticipate all of this. So we are in a market today which is dominated by electric vehicles. in the energy storage space. But the big question is stationary energy storage, and what is sometimes referring going to the future as long duration energy storage. So the big problem is that we think scalability and availability will become the major problem, not even too much about cost. And why is that? Because if we project ourselves into this future, basically we are in a situation where renewables are integrated progressively into the system, and the cost of deployments become cheaper and cheaper. We see also with lithium-ion batteries, but the demand for storage is expected to outpace the actual production. And then that's what does it mean in a very economic term is that we are reaching a world where price elasticity will decrease. So why is that? Because in urgent and constrained markets, usually demand becomes rather inelastic, and customers are less actually sensitive to price and more focused on access. That is a terrifying world, because in a world where 90% of lithium-ion is produced by China, batteries are refined in China, or in a world where there are not available resources, it becomes a frenzy. And for that to happen, basically, scalability means two things. One is availability of resources, and that is why whatever envision technology needs to not to rely on critical raw materials. And the second one is speed of production. And speed of production here is the real problem we realize that that has a solution, that is our solution, that can be brought to the market.
So let me rephrase this in my words to make sure I understand correctly. So, I mean, what you're saying is the currently dominating battery technology, which is lithium ion, the raw materials that we need are first and foremost not available to deploy batteries on scale. And even if we were to, dig them out and do that, there's still the 90% dependency on China, which we've learned over the past years in terms of supply chains and resilience there. It's not smart to put all your eggs in one basket. And what you're also saying, so even if sort of this supply side were there, the demand for battery storage will outgrow the supply side again, which means that more is needed, and thereby it's not ultimately a question of how expensive is it to produce the storage, but rather can you produce it fast, and are you able to produce it all, right? Those are the two questions that you bring to the table.
And in the end, of course, cost is the and price is the number one factor in a market transaction, of course. So as long as it's cost competitive, the real question becomes, is this available? Can be produced on demand?
And this
And
is, I think, then we said you bring the solution. What is the solution then?
So the solution, I would say from a conceptual standpoint, our solution is to basically to not just develop a lab prototype of let's say, of an ideal product, but to start really working on the product and the process together. What does it mean? It means that if you look at the category space, we took one of the most promising technology was invented by NASA more than 40 years ago, which is tank based, or referred sometimes to as a technically as you mentioned, redox flow batteries. And the reason why this has such a high potential as a technology is because they decouple power and capacity. So the actual electrolytes and the actual chemicals where you store the chemical energy and the power converter unit when you extract, let's say, the electricity or you charge and discharge, those two are separate. What does it mean? It means that the tanks, or let's say the electrolytes, the production rate of these electrolytes is so much faster compared to what a lithium-ion battery factory requires. We are around a factor of 60 off. The real problem we realized, and this is really because we started talking to customers from day one, I would say, is that this is such a promising technology, but the real problem is that the stack or the converter unit or the cell, the way it's designed, was not designed for speed and speed of production. Why is that? This design is around 10,000 times too slow compared to what the electrolyte production is. And so here's the beauty of the idea is saying, well, let's simplify. All major breakthrough in human history came because someone tried to simplify technology, not to make it more complicated. And I can tell you, after 2 years and a half in this world, flow batteries are freaking complicated. So let's try to simplify as much as possible. And we realize, well, let's remove the most refraining factor into this type of design, which is the membrane that separates the electrolytes. Now, initially, and this is, I think, the love that I have through a startup, because you figure out stuff only through the process. Initially, we thought, well, this accounts roughly for 30% of the cost, and you can simplify drastically the design. So there is a reason behind. Then we start realizing, well, it's not just about the cost, it's really about the assembly time, it's the production rate, how much the materials you put into this. Now you can drastically simplify this, and basically you can really reduce this by a factor of hundreds and thousands to the current standards. And this comes the beauty of the solution, because all of a sudden you can match the speed of electrolyte production with this speed of stack production.
And
And
out of a sudden, you have the solution that you're looking for, which is
exactly.
available and scalable, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And not only that, this maybe enters this more into what is really the unique selling point of this technology, is that at this point, once you remove the membrane, all of a sudden you have removed one of the most complex and fragile part of the system. You can almost entirely redesign the new system and produce injection molding. So in a most simple way that any kind of factory could produce, which means you don't need to establish huge complex factories just for the product. And this is something that investors like, and it's a very
I think this
capital
is a really
lean
important
system.
point, right? Like, you don't need to build your own factory. It's not a first
Exactly.
of its kind. You can use existing
Exactly.
technology that's been proven for decades now.
All biggest projects are struggling once they reach the stage. Why? Because they thought of the product without the process. And this is something we started from day one. And a second aspect, which is again we realized only through the process, is that all of a sudden, as these membranes usually are tuned to the specific type of chemistry, all of a sudden you have a system as ours, which is organic chemistry, which can work as long as you stabilize the interface. It can work without tuning it to a specific only one type of chemistry. That means that basically this can become literally a platform solution. And now it becomes a device where you can plug in different types of electrolytes and modify and scale this accordingly. And to give you an idea, the concept, how does it technically and feasibly happens, the concept is that you remove the membrane because you replace the two liquids with a similar to water and oil. And so all of a sudden you have a natural interface. Now the fluid dynamics and how to modulate this, that's the real
Right.
hard
This is where
part.
the real, yep.
The real innovation happens, yeah.
Okay. And I want to go back to this innovation part before, because when you started explaining sort of on the tech side, you said, you know, that ultimately the tank-based solutions, they're more than 40 years old, right? And I liked how you explained that real innovation always comes from simplification. So I think it's a really good point to take away. Why did no one else go down the path that you went down, or did anyone else
Oh
try to
yeah.
do it that way? Okay, but what is it again that then they focused on the tech side and not the process? Sort of, why are you advancing at such a high speed and, you know, bringing that solution to the market in a very short amount of time compared to if the technology's been around for so long? Why, you know, why is
Why
no one else
exactly?
making those
Why
waves?
us? Okay, yeah. I would say, for me, from my perspective, the major reason is that most of this, whoever tried or worked on this concept of a membrane solid flow battery, he really tackled it from a research perspective, almost at the university level. There has been project failed and it went into that direction. And one of the reasons is that it's such a big parameter space where you can optimize that you end up being lost in trying to make it slightly more efficient, and tune any KPI that you can take out of the system. And it's literally humanly impossible to see all the configurations. So one of the reasons why I believe we're making progress in that realm is because from day one, we started already envision what the system would look like. We started talking to customers. We started talking to the partners and figuring out, are we going in the right direction? Are we optimizing the right parameters? Are we going into a rabbit hole? And so all this interaction fueled ideas and breakthrough. Now, today, we are at the fourth generation of our membraneless concept. And every time there was some sort of inspiration that came almost from outside, from a walk, from a talk with a customer, from an industry expert who brought an idea. And all of this is not purely and only engineering work. It's a much more maybe human interactive work. And if you couple then that with the brightest minds you can ever get from postdocs and people with trainings from ETH, of course, this is where we are also standing today. And you put it into a hub, almost like the Zurich area, where you have access to so much talent. That's a powerful combination. And I think there is no other moment in time in history where this could have happened, if not now. And we just happen to be part of it.
Right.
And yeah, this I believe is the secret sauce.
Gotcha.
Oh, yeah.
And so, just to sort of summarize that, because you mentioned it, the sort of on the use piece of the technology, but just to make this really clear, what you're saying is the scalability of the stack now matches the availability of the liquids, right? Of the
Yeah, electrolytes, yeah.
electrolytes. Thank you. And is that's the sort of secret sauce, because that allows you your cost competitive with other solutions, I would assume, but the speed of scalability and thereby availability, plus you're not reliant on critical raw materials. That's really your USPs. Did I get that right, or what did I
Yes,
miss?
exactly. You got it right. Then when you go, let's say, into the use cases, and this is more going to the tier of a lean startup model. So once you start talking to a specific customer, you figure out that you have some special features of your system. Maybe they're not unique, but they are really needed by the
Right.
customer. An example
But then
is
let's stay there. So, what are use cases of your technology, or who? Because I read Amazon is one of your first customers, which is obviously, big deal, big name.
definitely.
Maybe give us more insights into the customer profiles that you're talking to.
Yes. So the customer profile, it really depends on the stage we're talking to. So depending on when we, let's say now we are in a pilot phase. So we target specific units and specific pilot projects. When we talk about the target customer, instead we're going to be energy producers or IPPs. Whoever has looking for maybe a co-location of renewable energies asset with energy storage, and more in details. So we have three great macro categories of customers in our realm. So one is really commercial industrial energy users. You can imagine Amazon as one of those where they have logistics centers and they have maybe a fleet of electric vehicles for the last mile logistics. They are the biggest IPP in Europe in terms of renewable energy production, and then they want to couple this. And what they're facing is a buffer during the night where they need to recharge their electric vehicles, and they have produced the energy during the day, and so they need a battery that lasts at least 4 to 8 hours. And so what they're looking here in the use case here, it's really on a solution that is cost competitive. And they can replicate at the multiple sites after the first pilot. And then you have instead energy infrastructure. These are grid operators or power producers. And what they're really looking for is something that is efficient and is available on demand once they know they will start integrating more and more of these renewable energies assets. And in that case, let's say there is not today a technology that is highly efficient that can provide this type of flexibility service. And lastly, I think it's not directly it's rather always difficult to combine and try to make it as a unique categorization, because energy storage is prone to what is called revenue stacking. So you can use the same system for several applications all at once. You can go into an ancillary market, you can go to a capacity auction, and you can use the same system. But what we noticed is that as the world is progressing in these years, artificial intelligence is starting to pick up. And we have all these projections on, let's say, the progression of that. But the point is that these data centers have fluctuating demand, and they usually have backup requirements. And that is not surprising that some of the partners we are talking to, like FlexSpace, that are installing big data centers, at the same time they want to couple with massive energy storage requirements. And for that, and this is going back to one of not I would say one of the unique selling points, but it turns out that this is a problem already into the system, is that for them they can't have a flammable system. It's too risky. And now all of a sudden we have organic chemistry, water-based electrolytes, and flow batteries can
Super safe.
provide. Yeah. If you couple that with the speed of production, basically you have the you solve both problems at once.
Right. Which, as just sort of on the domain of the AI hyperscalers, I mean, they're moving so fast. So, sort of having a partner that's able to bring technology at a similar speed is obviously really helpful, I would assume, to sort of say, look, we have plans to scale up massively, so do you. I think that works pretty well, sort of just from a company culture fit as well, right?
Absolutely. Is matching the speed. Everything is
Yeah.
about speed.
Everything is about speed, especially in the startup ecosystem. And I think that brings us perfectly to the next part of the conversation, which is I mentioned in the beginning that you just closed one of the biggest pre-seed funding rounds ever in Europe. So congratulations on this once
Thank
more.
you.
Maybe tell us a bit more. Let's start maybe with an easy one. Fundraising in this ecosystem, you hear it from a lot of companies, and you mentioned before the wider difficulties in the maybe battery tech space, especially in Europe. We know the stories about Northvolt and others. That probably normally doesn't help a battery tech company to say, look, we're progressing battery tech in Europe, yet sort of the hyperscalers that were supposed to be there failed. How was fundraising in this climate for you? Was it easy, or was it hard? Maybe tell us a bit more about that.
That's a very good question. So, first of all, I would for sure would say it's not easy. So, fundraising is one probably of the hardest things where you need to get out of your comfort zone, especially for any founder at the very beginning. And let's say it's more the difficult part is matching what a VC fund or whatever other source of funding you're looking for, but matching what creating an expectation of what they're looking for, and try to tune in the rhetoric the vision you have, without basically selling your soul, saying, okay, I'm going to tune to whatever you need, I'm going to stick to my vision and constant on that. But now I'm going to spend a lot of the time in explaining to you why I think you're wrong, or why I think you're right, and why. And then you create a discussion, a dialogue. And what worked very well is that very often, basically through these dialogues, we understood when this was a constructive argumentation, when we destroyed or built on each other's ideas, and when instead it was really just a pure assessment. And those when became a critical constructive criticism, that those were the discussions where we realized, okay, this is a good partner. And
Yeah,
so
those are
what I th
constructive,
yeah
right?
exactly. And I think what probably it's goes again to human behavior, let's say, but it's what probably a lot of founders forget is that this is a market. it's a matching market where you have on the other side someone who's looking for maybe a company in the energy storage space, and you're looking for funding, and someone who agrees to your vision and is not gonna take your company to an on the side to a different route, and that's it. Then you need to play by the rules. And the rules is about what is a pre-seed funding, how much you're raising, is it compatible to the target ownership of a VC fund, which basically all of this means that you need to do a lot of research and a lot of talk in advance. So to all the other funders outside, I would say the whole reason why this was for us a successful story is because we got non-dilutive funding at the very beginning that allowed us to basically learn how to play this game.
Right.
And of course, if you go fundraising from day one when you had just have an idea and you're an outsider, it's really difficult to get into
And I
this.
think that's also an interesting shift, right? I think this is somewhere the narrative is shifting towards to sort of build a capital stack of different sources, right? And I think this is also what you did in this funding round now, to not just have equity funding but also grant funding, and just sort of match these smart or package them smartly together in order for you to allow you to scale a company, not be overly dependent on VCs, and not be, I guess, losing ownership in your company very early on, knowing that there will be tough capital requirements as you scale along. Because, you know, if we're talking 14 million plus in pre-seed funding, that just means sort of the next funding rounds, and with the plans that you have, will probably be a lot larger. So sort of with that, you know, a dilution becomes an issue, and so on and so on. I think that's a smart way and a smart advice for every other founder out there, to say, look at the available sources of capital, and then sort of pack them together in whatever format and whatever stack works for you.
Yes, totally. I agree. And this is again, it's about what works for the single startup. Like we are hardware, and we needed to create an entire test facility by equipment that is in the hundreds of thousands of francs.
Yeah,
So
it's super
it's really
expensive.
exactly. So if you wanna, you need to go that route. But at the same time, it's really stage dependent. So as you said, it's like building capital stack means that you realize you can unlock certain opportunities just because you start the conversation early on in advance. So for instance, in the for this round, it was impossible, given the stage we're in, to unlock any debt opportunity or project finance, and we'll work basically towards that in the next years, and then to make sure basically it's I mean, from a financial perspective, there's a equity to debt ratio, but in general, to make sure that, as you said, we don't dilute too much and we keep the core of the company solid for the next rounds.
And now that you have, you know, your financing, what are you going to do with that money? You just hinted towards it, but, you know, 14 million in the bank, more or less. What are you going to do?
So yes, no, this is good for precision, to make it precise. So this is the total amount we raised for a pre-seed round, but of this accumulate also on the funding we received over the past 2 years and a half. So of fresh equity that comes into the company, we're talking about 6 million euros. And so the plan that we have is to work on expanding the team over the next 4 months, to expand your team, moving basically to system engineers and process engineer, and to deploy the first pilot next year. That's the number one aspect that we will focus on. In the end, as a startup, there's probably one of the secrets, going back maybe to how did we make it work. So as that we from day one we structured the company among the five of us, the five co-founder, as basically a formal company, established company will be structured. So there is a financial arm, technical, operational, and then CEO, and then the business development. Since then, this is still the case. So as activities, we're still focusing on that. Then actually internally, how do you develop organization? Clearly at this stage is all on engineering and product development. And so this allowed basically to progress in parallel on all different factors while focusing the money, let's say, on the core milestone, which is this pilot deployment. We will also focus on on basically on the contract manufacturing. So this is what I was talking about, developing the product and the process together. So the whole point is to, while we're doing that in parallel, to establish contracts and partnerships with contracts and leverage the also the letter of intents we had from Flexbase, Ekoni, Amazon, all these partners we gathered, so to a pioneering agreement. And at the same time, unlock even more debt financing for the next round or public guarantee schemes in Switzerland and in Europe. There are quite a few.
Yeah, and I think
And
especially sort of over the last years, that again has shifted, right? As we see sort of the supply chain issues, and Northvolt, I think, is a good example as well. You know, they received also quite
yeah,
some
so
public money. So it is possible for Europe to sort of make
it
those
is
bold
possible
bets.
if you strategically plan in advance. So
Yeah,
we
exactly.
absolutely want to learn also from the mistakes, and that's also what I'm gonna focus my next 2 years on. Yeah.
Maybe that's a good segue again. Sort of, the pilot is next year, but what's the longer vision? Sort of where, you know, what are the big milestones for you in order to scale up the company and bring the technology really to market?
Yes, so this is a very good question. Past this horizon, let's say, let's move ahead to 4 to 5 years, is to really have established this supply chain partnerships and moving to have a commercial pilot deployed already in the field. We're talking about technology readiness level 7, and that allow basically to have operational hours enough to have, let's say, a modular system that point and can be deployed. This will be what is typically referred to as a Series A when you enter into a scale-up phase, and this is the market entry. Clearly for us will be in Europe, given the partnership we're making. And then, so this is going to be basically the main focus, with headquarters still in Switzerland based, but basically bring really the product to the market. And this means that by then, we'll have activated all this working capital loan and financing tools to allow to make that vision a reality. And that vision is what we're referring to, really, to have figured out exactly this execution. How can I say?
Playbook.
Yeah, playbook that fits into a regulatory framework in Europe, but at the same time doesn't need to play exactly by the rules. In other words, after 2 years and a half in the story, we realized that a lot of opportunities are created once you show to the market that a different solution is available.
Right. And that's a quite interesting, right? This is where originally the also my interest in you came from, that a lot of when we talk about battery tech, I think everyone, as you also rightfully explained earlier, tends to think about EVs, tends to think about lithium ion, tends to think about sort of the gigafactories that have been built. But what you're saying is, look, there's another better solution out there. You know, why don't we go down this route? And out of a sudden, that sort of unlocks that momentum for you to say, right, you know, what opportunities are open? What can we do differently? How can we adapt regulation? How can we adapt certain financial tools in order to support that scale-up journey
Yeah.
in Europe?
Yes, exactly. And this is more generally speaking, like the real impact that one day we envision having. So a lot of the work, and again, going to the structure of different expertise and so on the co-founding team. So a lot of the work is also on advocacy. So figuring out, I mean, we are rather early stage, but already pushing really, let's say, those people who have power and decision power at the European level. Prove and show them that these type of technologies, and let's say we enter into a broader perspective of long-duration energy storage technologies, these are available. And a lot of the schemes today are not made for that. So I was talking, we were in Rome talking to the president of ARERA, and we were discussing about the role of the MACSE, which is a new auction tool only for energy storage in Italy. It's a new pioneer, let's say, pioneering experiments in the European landscape. And we figured out that this is not structure that meant for long duration energy storage. And when
Right.
we asked why, I said, well, because as of now, there are not this technology available. I said, okay, here we are. We are here exactly to tell you our story, to tell you this is available over the next years. Please figure out how to make the scheme incentivize the deployment of these type of technologies. And then basically we can work together with other flow battery companies. And this again, where do we how does playbook, if you look into the European context, how it could be could win, is realizing that it's a systemic change. So we're not coming in as a single battery
I was going to say
manufacturing
the
producer.
ecosystem is wider, right? Like, and it's not just sort of
Exactly.
your type of technology either. There's multiple
No,
approaches, compressed air. You know, you were just talking about Italy, so I think
this
of
is,
Energy Dome,
yeah,
for example. You know, there's so
exactly.
many different players in the field, and I guess what you're all advocating towards too is that systemic change, moving away from sort of a single type of battery solution to
Exactly.
wider, long-term duration storage.
Yeah, exactly. In the end, when we talk about flexibility tools, it's going to be a combination of different technologies, from iron air to exactly energy dome, as you mentioned as an example. All of these will play out in the scheme. And the market, it's such an unsaturated market and such an expanding market that it's more about let's create momentum, let's build these technologies. Then, if we have enough momentum, let's not try to replicate what China is doing and create a second Northvolt and compete on sodium ion or lithium ion. That battle we lost. So let's try to create a new ecosystem. And that's what we're working a lot on.
Yeah, and there's enough space for the different technology types, right? Like, as you mentioned in the beginning, you said the demand will so much outpace the supply that we see. So it's the different players in the ecosystem are needed in order to make that energy transition work and supply that energy storage capacity that we need.
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, this was quite a ride. I have one final question for you,
Yeah.
and that goes back to sort of everything that we talked about. But I would say you have an unusual background in the as one of the co-founders in the climate tech, battery tech space, and you pointed this out earlier. You know, being an economist and having worked in different fields, also in the impact sector, having done the PhD and so on. I would assume there would have been different routes for you to take professionally, right? Like, I mean, you chose the one on entrepreneurship because you really wanted this. Then again, I guess that it's been quite a ride since founding Unbound Potential. But what is it that keeps you going? Because now that you've raised the pre-seed round, you know, again, a massive round, but there's a whole lot of work left to do for you as a company and you as a team to really, well, fulfill the potential of the technology and of the company, right? Like you've taken the first steps, so to say. Like it's quite a distance that you've covered. But then again, if you look at where you need to go, it's still quite a distance to go. So maybe you've come from, I don't know, like in a toddler speak, you managed to from crawling to walking. But now, you know, there's still the scale up and grow
Yes.
up phase to the teenage years and to making it fully to adult stage. What is it that keeps you going and keeps you motivated to do that job and to deliver that technology?
So yeah, thank you. That's such a beautiful question, and I honestly probably ask myself this question every single day. What keeps me and everybody in our team going? Me specifically, I'm passionate about problem solution. So it just you can give me whatever problem, and I just intrinsically want to figure this out. And it can become quite difficult to handle a mind like that. But it's basically a feeling of being challenged. And every time I hear someone says, "Oh, this is not possible. Oh, this is too difficult." I feel like, dude, if I manage to reach this point in my life, I think I can figure this out. It's not that difficult. We can do it. And very often what I realized is that is in the process. This step by step is where most of the people get lost. And a technical solution is basically, and going back to this mantra, so a good idea without execution is worthless. The other way around, if you put right, good execution and focus, and you bring the right actor into place, that is possible. And just, I could be in any space. It could be in climate change. I could be doing any type of job. This is one of the most challenging and risky environment. And what I realize is that this is a very fertile environment. I love it. And then it keeps me going. And then on a more personal level, so I think what keeps me going is I think it was around 6 years ago, 5 years ago, when I was working in a completely different field. So we're working on on the coffee sector and the climate change impact and the value chain of coffee production. And I was talking with this farmer. I mean, at least I speak some Spanish, so I think I understood him right. But I was talking to him and his experience while assessing a disease of coffee plantations, and while I was basically lost into the technical issues of this, this dude looked at me and said, "Why are we asking me all these questions?" I said, "Well, because I want to figure out the solution to this problem." I said, "Yes, but do you realize that because of the climate change now, my crops are not as productive as before. I'm losing everything. My family has migrated to the United States, and my entire village is basically shut down." And that, I remember, it hit me deeply, and I realized, what the hell am I working on? Like, this guy has absolutely no power and is affected by the biggest externality humankind's ever created, which is climate change, and has no solution. And then it kicks in a feeling of responsibility. You realize it's not that I have the solution, but if I can make it happen, I'm gonna work my entire life for this.
And
And
it goes back to what you said before, right? Like, if someone poses a problem, and that's probably one of the biggest problems there is, right? Like, the farmer says, "Look, my means to make a living here are being destroyed. I don't have a solution. I don't know what to do." That's a very big problem to solve. And I think this goes back to what you described before. Like, then you're the one looking for the solution. How can you contribute to finding that solution? Emilio, this was a ride. I mean, all I could say is I'm really looking forward to you guys scaling up and bringing that technology to market. I'd love to catch up in, a few years' time to see how far you've come and how that mantra of process and product has worked out for you. Until then, best of luck with all the next steps. Keep that momentum, and thank you so much for making the time today. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Jan, for having me, and I'm looking forward to being back in a couple of years maybe, or even before,
Exactly.
showing the progress that we made.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.